We're back. This is Mask Off, a podcast about life, mental health, and hip-hop. Today, on episode 12, we got a great friend, somebody I've known 20-plus years, worked with, actually managed. You guys will know his work. And since the conversation got a little long, we're going to break this one up into two parts, all right? So we're going to get started with part one right now. Welcome to Mask Off. My name is Dylan Michael Salmon. Yes, the full. You get the full name here.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know. You are revealing.
Yeah. You know, it's Mask Off. Can't heal what you don't reveal.
That's
right?
It.
You gotta, you know, gotta get out there. So
nicely put.
You know, we sit here, you know, we hang out with our friends, and you know, we chop it up and we find out how you become the person, the famed person that you are sitting in front of me now. Right?
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of what this is about. So sitting in front of me is a well-known friend, photographer, documentarian, especially in my favorite culture of hip-hop, but amongst many other places, fashion and advertising and tons of spots, right? Right? He is, well, I'll let you introduce who you are, right? Because this is Mask Off. You reveal who you are. Right? This is
Jonathan Mannion. Live and direct,
live
downtown,
and direct.
New York City, November 26, 2018.
Oh,
we are
shit.
Here.
We're dated now.
We are dated.
Okay.
It's important. All right. I think it's important to put dates on things.
Okay.
You know, it shows growth. It shows where you've been and where you're going and where you're aspiring to go. So it's part of the Mask Off. I don't know. Just made that up.
I mean,
sounded good, though.
Yeah, but I mean, well, we've been doing this for a long time, so we have this banter, and we can go back and forth, and sometimes we digress, and sometimes, you know, but it's
we often digress. It's about 80% digressions with us, man, but
that's part.
We're gonna dive into the sub,
but,
you know,
but we get the work done.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Amidst the digression, right? So
absolutely.
I think that's a skill also in itself.
Correct.
Right. It's an art.
Man,
well, there's some form to it. Right?
Getting anything done in this world is an art form.
Well, like I'm sure
itself.
We'll get into, you know, tennis. You like tennis?
I do.
Right,
I enjoy tennis.
But like I said, so you know, this is just candid conversations amongst friends, right?
Cool.
There's no questions. There's no anything. This is really, like I said, this is us finding out how you became the person sitting in front of me today, right?
Wow.
So dates, right? So you, who you are now, right? But where did it all begin? What was the family structure? Where did you know? Where were you born? All that kind of stuff. So let's go all the way back to the beginnings.
Yeah, and I'll dive a little deeper. I think it's interesting, and it is that moment to reveal you know, maybe some pieces of the puzzle that don't always get spit out. That's usually the question that I skim over, like, yeah, I'm from Cleveland, grew up, you know, went to Kenyon College, and then I moved to New York in 93, and it started, and I worked for Abaddon, and boom, 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 like, then I'm into my real life, what I consider my real life, when in fact my real life and the entire formation of who I am as a human being came from prior to 93. How I operate in this world, how I engage people, how I hold them high, how I contribute to them, to their betterment, to their betterment, and, you know, to their success has always been a reflection of, you know, sort of my family structure and how I grew up. My dad's from Brooklyn. You know, so that's always been the sprinkle of a little bit of gangster, you know, in my mind. Like, my grandfather used to drive alcohol during Prohibition, throw bare knuckle boxing matches on 3rd Street and 7th Avenue.
Nice.
Like, dock worker, like, you know, really humble beginnings. But, you know, I learned the cloth that I'm cut from.
Okay.
You know, that's father's side. Mother's side, you know, there's definitely rogues in the family that go way back, as my mom, you know, chased her family tree to see where the roots led. And but you know, ultimately, mother's from London, and you know, bigger family on that side, you know, as cousins, and spent a lot of time overseas. And really, that was such a beautiful component of my development, to learn that in 5 hours you could change the entire world. In my mind, you know, still speaking English, and like, yeah, it wasn't maybe as drastic change as Tokyo would have been, or the Philippines, or Australia, or something like that. But it was still like, you can go somewhere where you are not known.
Yeah.
At
the culture is completely different.
And culturally, certainly different. But and a culture that I really, enjoyed. You know, I didn't have the same I'm a white boy from Cleveland upbringing because of the Brooklyn roots and the London sort of blend of, you know, of what that was. You know, it was always, you know, I was in the pubs with my uncle at age like 8, you know, drinking by 13, 14. So that was never like, we got to make a fake ID in high school and college, you know what I mean? To like be able to buy alcohol. Like it was just never part of the run of show, as it isn't for, I think, a lot of people in New York as well. Like, you know, the rules are a little more lax, and they always were that for me growing up, you know?
But born in Cleveland.
But born in Cleveland.
Right. And then when did you start going to London?
I had traveled to London twice before I was 1 year old. So I had traveled, you know, constantly. Every year that we would go, probably for maybe, two or three weeks every year to go and spend time. And, you know, it was enough to... You know, I can't say that I lived there exactly, but, it was a close-knit, you know, sort of family. So when I was there, it felt like an eternity.
Of course.
Even though it was a short amount of time because of entirely new stimuli and just, you know, aunts and uncles that don't get to see you are just, you know, heaping on the love and spoiling you immensely.
But as you go back, it feels each time as you go back like you haven't left in a sense, right? Like you just kind of start from where you left off. With everybody.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? So that's what I'm saying. So it felt like home to you almost, like a second home.
Without a doubt, yeah. I mean, there was a way of being there. And, you know, what's interesting is, like, I look back, I'm an only child as well, you know? So it was like I grew up being comfortable in my own skin, occupying my own space, you know, in a way that I didn't really need a lot. You know, I had a lot of friends in the neighborhood, but I could then say, okay, I'm slicing that off. I need some me time. And I was quite comfortable, you know, sort of like being an observer and being a little quiet, you know. And, you know, it's just over time you develop, you know, through confidence and through, you know, just experience. I think you develop into the person that you're meant to become. But I think early on, I think it was always, you know, I was more on the quiet side, except when it came to sports. You know, I was a big soccer player, big tennis player, big, you know, sort of football in the neighborhood and basketball once I had a growth spurt because I was always a little dude. And then finally, like, grew. I was like, oh, great, sweet, I can play ball now, you know, little point guard. But not that I'm a towering giant right now, but, you know, it leveled the playing fields a little bit. But, you know, I look back at, you know, sort of me growing up in Cleveland, and it was just such a beautiful pace. Mm. You know, we had friends, you know, kind of everywhere, and you got a benchmark of how a kid was growing up in, you know, on the Upper East Side in New York City, you know what I mean, with a load of cash, you know what I mean? We had family friends that were very well off, you know, and then other family friends that weren't. And you just to see the balance of growth and development and to know that my parents kept me so grand still to this day, you know what I mean? Like, while I know that I'm a successful photographer, you know, anybody that really knows the true essence of me is like humble. I'm about the work. I'm here to work hard. I'm here to give back. I'm here to give, you know, in advance, not even back, but give before you've given to me, you know? And, I mean, I think it's a great way to be and in a world that continues to get stranger and stranger every day to have a balance within yourself that your core is strong and you are settled and to be well surrounded by great people like yourself that have been in my life for a really long time with similar journeys and trajectories in this crazy industry that we call hip hop, you know.
Some stabilities, right? Some things.
Yeah,
that...
man, just people that are like-minded. It's the people that you've also chosen to spend time with on the Mask Off podcast. You know, there are people that are respected. Lenny S., Clark Kent, you know what I mean? Just Blaze, name it, you know? I know you're only on, am I number 11 or 12? But
I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
I keep throwing all these numbers and times, man. We're going to have to, like, we have to be real careful about how we do this, like, strategize.
Strategery.
Yeah, a lot of strategery involved here, you know?
All right, man, shit. Well, 15, episode 13, episode 14, episode 16.
We'll get
I'll give you, you could slice and dice.
It's going to be there. But,
Yeah, man, I really do think that that has, and I think for the great ones, I think for the great artists, entertainers, athletes, the people that have had longevity have been well surrounded and well guided and well supported. And man, that's such a critical component because you can get lost in this sauce so quickly.
Oh, very cool.
You know, and you know, I've been thinking about it and talking about it constantly. This moment of comparison, you know, like comparing your life to everybody else's. You know, that, yo, it could bring a weak-minded individual to his or her knees immediately.
Oh, for sure.
You know, like, wow, I don't have that. I'm not doing that. I'm not balling. I'm not. I've been on 2 private jets in my life, 3. You know, like, man, wow, I got to do more. I got to hustle more. I got to make other choices. I got to, you know, like, it's really tricky to navigate. And, you know, again, it's just I'm grateful that there is the moment to unplug, to go settle, man, walk around the block, take your Frenchie for a walk, just breathe some air, sit, think, and then get back to work, you know.
I mean, but we kind of need those daily resets, right? And then, you know,
sure.
I think when once we, that's the tough thing about social is that you start looking at what everybody else is doing, right?
Sure.
And just like you said, we all have our journeys. Mm. Some things are similar or relatable, but they're all our own journeys, right? And once we start,
sure.
Like I was doing that, and I always say, once you start counting other people's blessings,
yeah.
Only thing you look at is things you haven't done.
Yeah.
Right? You think about your misses, right? Instead of all the things that you have, right? And so it's, you know.
Without a doubt.
That's why, but again, that's why these things are fun, because like the reflection, and then we even learn something about ourselves, right? When we start talking about where we came from,
mm-hmm.
right? And then how we kind of not even circumvent, but how we go through these things and deal with these emotions, these ups and downs. Because, I mean,
sure.
Shit, there's always times where things are better than others. Right?
Without
a
doubt.
Or things are like you got this momentum and everything's rocking, and then all of a sudden shit just kind of skirt stops. Right?
Sure.
But everything happens for a reason. It's just how we.
Yeah, no. It's the ebbs and flows of it. And I think that you do need to, like, need to, you know? it is. It would be lovely to not experience a lot of the lows. But the lows really show you what you're made of, and the character, you know, the content of your character. How do you bounce back? How do you, you know, sort of like, okay, cool, this sucks right now. But, yo, this is it. This is a valley to be able to understand the peaks and to really celebrate those highs, you know, as well as the lows, because that's, yo, people don't make it through them all the time, you know, and they're just like, oh, I can't do this. I can't do this, and I'm out. And they might be just, you know, stifling what their calling really is because they're not brave enough to step forward, you know?
Well, I mean, you got a lot of bounce back. Where did that come from? Was that always there? Was that from family?
I'm a resilient dude, man.
What's that from? Is that from family? Did you learn that from
parents?
It's
understanding purpose,
okay.
You know? And, you know, purpose is, it develops over time, you know?
Yep.
Certainly, you know, So when I went to Kenyon College, right, small liberal arts school in Ohio, oldest school in Ohio, really beautiful place, like probably some of the richest years that I've experienced on this planet, just in personal growth and development and being surrounded by thinkers, and you're developing who you are going to become, right, in the world in general, at least the formative years of that. You know, I had an opportunity. I studied psychopharmacology and psychology, and I thought, okay, maybe I'm going to go to med school, right? And I was like, okay, well, that's a lot more studying, and you're into it, and you're good at it, and you enjoy it, and you enjoy it as it relates to helping people, understanding people, because that's really at the core of what makes the world go around for me, right? And then there's this crazy thing called hip hop that, you know, I was doing college radio. I was throwing all the parties at my school. You know, I'd go make 4-hour mixtapes at WKCO 91.9, you know, just to be able to put in the cassette and then auto flip it and then take out the next one and put it in. And it was Tribe Called Quest and da 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 and Common and NWA and everything that was kind of happening late 80s into, you know, up until 93. They were incredible years for a delivery of music. You know, if you look back to, you know, Slick Rick and Big Daddy Kane and DOC and all the reasons why I'm like what the fuck is that?
Like, right, before we go too far,
yeah.
What was the first hip hop record like? What was the song, first song? Was it King?
So there was a kid named Terrell Turk in an English class. I mean, look, there was pop radio as well.
Yeah,
you know,
course.
Cleveland, we got the basics.
But that doesn't necessarily mean, right? Like, I'm talking about that one that, like,
yeah. You know, it was probably the first tune that I remember hearing when he put the headphones on was Kool Moe Dee. And it was Go See the Doctor. And then it was Dana Day Nightmares. And it was Slick Rick something. And I don't remember. But I remember those two distinctly. And I was like, whoa, okay, this is crazy. And then listening through, I don't remember anything. I just remember like one of those yellow Sport Walkmans that clicked. And you put them on with the in-ear headphones that were little sideways chiclets. And you chucked them
little,
in.
Little metal.
Yep, the little metal thing, the Sport. Because they were sporty, and
they were water resistant.
And that was like the portal into like, wow, I need to know more about this. And then it was the discovery of Ice-T, Power, Big Daddy Kane, you know, the Ain't No Half Steppin' and every single one of his hits, like, and the DOC, you know, like that No One Can Do It Better. That album was like that, and Big Daddy Kane. Those are the two human beings that probably are responsible for me sitting here right now. Because I was like, that is just, it doesn't, like, what is this? Like, I have to know more about this. I have to chase this. I have to know everything. You know, I was going to school inner city in Cleveland, you know? Yep. So then it was like a different set of influences that once you tap into it and you become aware of the sound, then it was, you know, MC Breed, it was, you know what I mean? Like, Cleveland had the benefit of pulling music from everywhere.
Yep.
So we were pulling Ghetto Boys and Scarface. We were pulling West Coast and WA and Luke. And you know what I mean? It was just sort of this onslaught. And I don't remember specifically what happened when, but I know that once I did college radio, you know, and it was like my freshman year, I was like, I did an R&B show. Like, I was also an R&B fan. I'm probably, actually, truth be told, I'm a bigger R&B fan than I am a hip-hop fan in a lot of ways, you know?
So who was it R&B back then? You was Key Sweat guy?
Troop,
okay.
Key Sweat, like, man.
Were you humping around? You was Bobby Brown?
Yeah, and I wasn't humping around, but I wasn't humping around to Bobby Brown. I think it was probably like Babyface, you know, it was like, as soon as I get home, it was, you know, it was that kind of a vibe, but balanced out certainly with Tribe Called Quest and De La and, you know, incredible artists and creative thinkers that were delivering, you know, an onslaught of incredible music, you know, then, and I just felt like I was on the journey and was one of the people that was like, yo, this is dope. Because I went to school in the middle of nowhere. It was like there was no stoplight in my town. So, like, these were a bunch of, like, tree-hugging, Birkenstock-wearing, Creedence Clearwater Revival, Grateful Dead.
Okay.
You know,
right. That's not the picture I get from anywhere in Ohio.
Yo, that is okay. Kenyon College.
Thank you for
painting
that picture.
It's actually was rated the most beautiful campus. So it's like that really traditional old, the campus is from 1820 or something like that. I mean, it's insane. It's like farmland Amish pies for sale on Sunday with quilts, you know, and then a lot of like old Milwaukee, you know, kegs rolling in, you know, to feed the masses.
Wow. Yeah. So I never would have guessed that.
Yeah. I was, you know, probably part of, you know, maybe 10% of the campus that was into hip hop and would celebrate it or understand it. But we were the ones that like really said, yo, this is how we're partying, man. This is it. You know, and we threw the party and everybody knew that's where you have to be. Okay. The rest of it was just straight fraternity, like Animal House, you know, was cool. And that was fine too, you know, but like, when we wanted to kind of get down, like we were celebrating all the time. Like it was like kid and play kick stepping around parties and like sliding like Scoob and Scrap Lover, you know, in a dorm room. You know, it was like me and my boy Devin Odo, you know, this cat, like, because we had rhythm. Thankfully, my parents bought me the rhythm package, you know,
nice,
at birth.
Nice.
It's fantastic, man. Awesome. It's been a godsend.
Awesome. Yeah, you have to get that download.
I'm super grateful. Yeah, yeah. Oh,
it's a great download.
Yeah, it's a great. We got the app early. Yeah, which is cool.
Beta testing rhythm.
Yeah.
The rhythm app. Good shit.
Yep.
Early.
So, yeah, man. You know, so anyway, getting back to the choice, it was like, okay, move to. Go to med school somewhere,
yep.
Right? Or go to New York and try and be this rock star photographer.
But you didn't even talk photography. When did photography start?
I took it only 1 year at school. So
in college or high school too, or no?
Mm-mm. Yeah, both of my parents are artists. So I had the benefit of growing up looking at light, composition, painting, drawing, you know, that was always encouraged. Mm-hmm. And so it was sort of an unconscious piece of my puzzle, you know, sort of what I came to school with. So like being an art major, mm-hmm. It didn't feel fair. I felt like I was like cheating the system. If I just did art, you know, it's like of me. I mean, now it's sort of like,
yeah, it's like,
it's fantastic. It's like,
sounds more like you saying you went to school for pharmacology sounds and feels more like the face you were just making.
Yeah.
Like,
but it was quite the opposite for me. Doing art felt like I was cheating. I was wasting, you know, sort of whatever, my parents' money, my money, the school's allotment. You know, I was like, yo, I'm not just going to waste it, like, drawing pictures and making sculpture. Like, that's not fair. Like, so I need to come away with something, quote unquote, real. And okay. That was at least psychology. That felt like a discipline. Okay. You know what I mean? That wasn't like art.
But we talked about that before, and I'm sure you'll get into it more. But
sure.
Observation, right? You said you were quiet.
Mm-hmm.
You're always observing.
Not so much in college, you know. College,
no, but as a child. But as a child,
yeah.
Right? And
definitely.
So while you're coming up, composition, understanding that from your parents and learning, mm-hmm. right, watching that just by being observant,
mm-hmm.
and I think your inspiration came with the music. Like that's when you felt like you had something to attach or apply,
yeah,
all of that to. So then the decision to go to New York. How did you even have that choice? What was the
Well, I'll step back. There's two things, man, and I'll say, and we'll continue to touch on the subject. But, you know, I look back at quite literally every experience that I've had, and somehow all of them inform who I am now and who I will continue to become. You know, whether it's design or having a zillion Matchbox cars, which makes me love cars, which makes me like the isolation of driving because it's peace, because no one can find me. And, you know, and then I can think and I can think straight in my own space. Like,
how many cars have you had in shoots that you've done as well?
How many cars? Yeah, I'm utilizing cars and knowing the angles. And
that's what I'm saying.
Sure. And being in L.A.
But as a reflection and looking back, you think of those things.
Yeah.
As
you don't know
in
the
moment.
You just know that you're drawn to it, you know?
But now, are you a little bit more clear when those things happen? Like, I feel I am.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like I feel like now I catch myself more in the moment. I'm going, hey, I wouldn't have caught that a few years ago.
No. You know, what's funny is I can look back like, oh, wow, that really is. Like, there are moments of enlightenment. And mm-hmm. for me, it's always looking back. You know, like, okay, that aligned and I did that and this was cool. And even me being comfortable, like super ultra comfortable doing a podcast, one with you because you're my guy, two, because I really enjoyed the medium of radio having done it for 4 years. Mm. Like, this is awesome. Yeah. You know, there's a comfort in the familiarity of it.
Yep.
You know, and, you know, I like my voice, you know. I'm a sultry, smooth, you know, take them home at the end of the day kind of guy.
It's the R&B guy coming out again.
It is totally the R&B guy.
What was your name for the show?
Oh, man. Yeah, I think I was like something ridiculous, like Cool DJ Johnny M or something. You know what I mean? Like the most.
Did you have a jacket? Did you make like a satin jacket?
There was no satin jacket. There was no satin in my wardrobe. Oh. No. I was a Carhartt hoodie. I was like a member of like Dos Effects or EPMD.
Oh, you were in Def Squad?
I was total Def Squad. Like, you know, like that was also part of it. That was understanding style as well. Like, you know, what's funny is like everybody in the whole low life crew, like I wore polo my whole life. I was like, oh my God, get me out of this. Get me into something that feels more hip hop. Where it was quite the opposite. It was this like, duality of cultural appropriation.
Yeah, but were you wearing high tech and like all of that? Were you wearing like you had to wear the collared like the polos with the horse and just the regular?
No, I mean we just bought polo because that's what was there and was in the malls and you know, but it was only like, look, I was the crazy dude that would call the marketing company of St. Ides to send out champion St. Ides sweatshirts. I was like, you know, I'm big time college radio DJ and, you know, we love the product and we love to represent it walking around camp. We just wanted sweatshirts. Like, and I have the illest like crooked eye hat and like, but that was the idea of acquisition and getting gear. It was this one of one mentality. I want the one of one thing, you know,
that it's that. But it's also like I call effort the natural filter.
Effort.
Effort.
Yeah.
Right. Like now. Effort is getting on your phone and going like this.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. If I want to buy a pair of shoes or the cool new this or that, I can find out where to get it by doing this.
Yeah, of course. Yo, we chose, man. You know,
that's
we
what I'm saying.
Really,
you had to figure out.
We sought it out. It was the McKinsey River Company in Oakland, California. And I was like, okay, this marketing company, and we're going to find these things, man. I'm going to get you some St. Ides thing. Like, do you guys make even hoodies? Can we buy them? They're like, oh, we'll send it. They're still the flyest, like, thick, super champion, like, button-down cardigan, saying, like, yo, I still have it. I still have all of these items that somehow are become the cherished moments. They're the touchstones of the journey as I look backwards, you know?
I mean, yeah, it's a fucking lot of them.
Yeah, a zillion, yeah.
All right, so then, so, all right, so get back to how you got to New York, the choice.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think it was a logical progression. So I took photography 1 year in school, right? It was, my professor's name was Greg Spade, also, you know, super accomplished, amazing photographer. And the year that I graduated, my school gave Richard Avedon, who is arguably the best to ever touch a camera, an honorary degree based on the fact that he had three employees prior to that year, 93, the year that I graduated, that were all Kenyan graduates, right? So one was class of 92, then one was like 90, and then the other was 87 or whatever. Like, and it, so all of his assistants were Kenyan grads. So the school said, thank you for looking after our people, essentially. And one of the kids I was in our classes with the year prior, and he was like, it's not for me. I'm not into this 7 a.m, go bring donuts and muffins and leave at 9 o'clock at night. And, you know, it's challenging. You just sign away your life and you do whatever Avedon wants you to do and the team wants you to do. He's like, I just have more that I want to accomplish, you know? And I was like, well, that sounds cool. I mean, the way, he's like, you know, but get, it's an incredible experience. And like you, it really opens the doors up. So go for it. And so there was a formal and official sort of ask from Avedon studio, like, hey, are there any great students that you think you would put forth? And he asked me if I wanted it, and he only put me forth. He was just like, okay, we got one kid, you know, and I really was, you know, I was in the dark room constantly. It was magic to me, you know, sticking some paper and some chemicals and then just, you get magic. It's like, do that again. That's amazing. That's like true magic to me. I know it's...
But what was the magic part? The magic part was just the actual...
Seeing the images.
But
appear.
Seeing your images?
Seeing
like
my
seeing
images
what you
appear.
Were looking at? Or was it just the magic of... What was the first thing?
The magic initially was that an image could appear on paper.
Okay. So you cared about the craft. You
cared I cared about the cared, craft.
Yeah, you cared about like how
and
it
then
actually...
when it was my image, and then I realized that I was a good printer and I could... Okay. I understood the mechanics, if you will, or, you know, of printing.
So you cared about how the image was created and how it came out.
Sure.
Like messing around in the dark.
Yeah, I was
out
in the dark
to,
room constantly, just right. Music blaring and printing.
Right.
Like I was printing on my graduation night.
But that's
because
much,
I sold my show to the deans of the college. You know, so everybody else is doing keg stands for one last time. And, you know, and quite literally, and it probably went in my favor. There were people, other Kenyan graduates who came back to see Avedon get his degree, because Avedon is revered as like, it'd be the equivalent for the listeners of like Michael Jordan to basketball is Avedon to photography.
I mean, just give him, give them a quick like 20,000 foot real quick Avedon. Yeah.
Avedon revolutionized fashion photography in the 40s, worked with major, major sort of designers like Brodovich, and photographed writers and painters and dancers, you know, known for this, like, the connection, the psychology between the sitter and the photographer. That was sort of really what he was known for. He did a book called In the American West, where he essentially, like, chose faces that he just was, that he found interesting or were compelling characters, and put a book together that is really kind of known as one of his major things. But politicians, I mean, anything that reflected, you know, art, culture, politics, fashion, you know. Like, when I was there for that year, we did a Versace campaign, and we photographed, you know, Gianni Versace and his boyfriend at the time, the full campaign with, like, Naomi.
Hold on. You gotta, like, see, you just skipped over the best part. See, when I know the people, like, I can't let them just jump over this stuff, so I have to rewind. Just the bar. You gotta, the bar. Your first day on the job. I know people out there know this, but there's some people that
the
don't.
The Naomi story?
See, now you're just gonna say it like that.
The Naomi story?
That one?
Are they ready for the Naomi
story? I mean, but
the first day I got introduced on the job was to Stephanie Seymour, and Avedon said, "Oh, this is the new guy, Leo. We love him." Like, I literally had just interviewed. He asked me, my interview question was, "Tell me about your parents." And I was like, "Oh my God." I was like, "This is the easiest question I've ever been asked in my life. My parents are my world. Like, I love them and understand the meaning of unconditional love because of them. It is one thing that I know for certain in this world, and there's not too many things that I know for sure. But that is one. That is an inseparable connection, a little trifecta in this crazy big world. You know what I mean?" But so I got the job. He was like, "Yo, he's perfect." And I had already moved. I had all my stuff and had bags. And they basically said, "Look, you know, you got the job pretty much, but you got to nail the interview. Pack as if you're going to live here." I was like, "Okay, cool. No problem." You know, put all my crap in a duffel bag and stayed in an ex-girlfriend's place who had a new boyfriend. She's like, "Yo, you take my brownstone on 11th and 7th. And I was like, "What's my life? Like, this is amazing." Thank you, Leslie. Even to this day, thank you, Leslie.
That's awesome.
And so she allowed me to kind of plant my feet for about a month and find a place to live, and did very quickly, and total bachelor pad kind of thing. But anyway, so we go to the interview, ask me the question, and then as soon as we were walking out, Stephanie Seymour, major supermodel, walks in, and Avedon's like, "Oh, this is the new guy. We just hired him. I just hired him." He's like, "This is now the guy that we get to shit on." I was like, "Oh my God, what did I sign up for?" And she's like, "Oh, like, you're super sweet." Gave me this huge hug. And I was like,
"That's what you signed
up
for.
Ultimate, like, crazy alternative reality is this?" Yeah. Like, you know, and she, like, put this crazy, like cab driver hat on that I just didn't take off ever until she finally asked for it back a week later. Like, did I leave my hat there? I had to give it back. But, you know, it's just like one of these, it's weirdo things, but really one of the really, it will be a memory that I will remember, I'm sure, when my life flashes in front of me, you know, when it's all said and done, when I'm 120.
that'll be one of the blips,
like.
But that one is great, yo.
Yeah, so we were shooting the Pirelli calendar, and Naomi Campbell was one of the models. And, you know, young Naomi Campbell, I'm 22 years old, living in New York, right? So 22 or 23.
She's probably 19 or...
a baby. Yeah, I don't know what she is now, but, you know, still looks spectacular and amazing as she did then, you know? And I was there, and I was the low man. I was like the, you know... I was the guy that they would say, "All right, go load this, you know, 100 sheets of film in the dark." You know, and you go into the closet and fucking load it up and come back out and say, "All right, here's the sheets." And then, like, "Okay, go back in. We need 100 more." Like, okay. So, like, I spent a lot of time
in the dark.
In the closet. And then I would come out of the closet. And then I would go back in the closet. Like, uh-huh. No relation. Yeah, man. So I was there, and they're like, "Okay, well, we need you on set now because Naomi has to roll around in sand to get sand. Like, we're going to oil her back, and then she's going to roll around in sand as if she's been laying on the beach for a long time, nude. And I was like, okay, whatever I got to do, I'm here to do it. You know what I mean? Like, we're super willing, eager, Midwest, you know, good old Cleveland boy kind of thing. Not a good old boy, but, you know. And Naomi's there rolling around, and I'm standing at her feet with a hairstylist who was next to me. Meanwhile, there's like 50 people there, right? Because it's art directors and this and that and stylists and hair and Donatella Versace and Orbe and like every big name fashion person was there, you know? And Naomi's there, and I'm standing, so we're like toe-to-toe, like so with toe-to-heels. So she's laying out in front of me at 12 o'clock. And yeah, and she's rolling and rolling, and then she just like looks at me, and she just like raises both of her arms, you know? And I had one of those like Wonder Year moments where you're looking at the fourth wall, and I just looked down, and I was just smiling as she was there. She sort of smirked. And I just remember looking up at like the entire room, and they're all like, dude, pick her up, man. Like, pick her up. Like, we got to work. Like, they were ready to work. And I must have just like bust this goofy ass little 22-year-old grin. Like, fucking, this is my life. I'm picking up butt ass naked Naomi Campbell from rolling around in the sand, respectfully, you know, but inside my body. I'm like, oh my God, like, what is happening? This is incredible. Like, this is what I signed up for, man. Like, and yo, I'm so happy. I'm going to work harder to stay and keep this job because of this moment. And, you know, picked her up, turned her around, you know, and say, you okay? She's like, yep, I'm good. Thank you, love, you know, and dashed off. And I was back in probably in the black box loading film. But that as a highlight was like, you know, same thing. It was like Christy Turlington. Like, you know, she was holding these brambles. Same job, you know, another day. She's topless. You know, Christy Turlington, topless for the Pirelli calendar, holding these brambles. And she's like, my arms are really getting tired, Dick. You know, and this was, you know, to Avedon. Dick Avedon, Richard Avedon. You know, sorry. You know, sorry.
Clarification.
She's like, and he's like, oh, hey, hold the brambles. Hold the brambles so she can put her arms down. You know? So I'm here holding brambles. Luckily, I'm strong and I wasn't shaking and sweating. And, you know, I was an athlete. Like, cool. So I'm there. I'm holding these brambles. And she is there, absolutely, totally topless. And, you know, I'm trying just like, don't look down. Just don't look down. Just look in her eyes. Look at the sky. Examine the brambles. Like, just... don't look. Oh shit, you just looked at her tits. Okay, let's not look at her tits. You did it again, bro. You just keep on going back to the tits. Like, be respectful. Like, be a grown up. Try and be a grown up. Like, fuck, you just did it again, bro. Like, it was just, I mean, it was a lost cause, you know. I had many glances about 2 feet away from the promised land, you know. And it was, again, it was like, and that wasn't even the hip-hop, that was just me learning my craft and feeling my way through New York, you know. But the balance of that, of learning that craft and learning from the best and learning how the biggest jobs were being done start to finish, was the ability to go home, to get a slice of pizza, and then to go out to the clubs. Ooh. Where I realized there was access to what I wanted, what moved my soul, which was music. Okay. You know, and even going back, music has always been, and I know it sounds, you know, a little cheesy, but it's always been the soundtrack to my life. It's also been something that I have chosen for myself, whether that was choosing to listen to The Cure and New Order or Depeche Mode prior to that, choosing to listen to The Police or Genesis or something prior to that, choosing to listen, you know, in 88, choosing to, you know, discover Buju Banton and Beanie Man and, you know, like diving into Gregory Isaacs and like, yo, that was sort of, these were always the moments of discovery that led me forward, you know?
But music.
That was it.
But you didn't get that from Avedon. That was always what
No. Yeah. I digress.
So after Avedon, then who was other photographer you worked with?
So after Avedon, my commitment was a year and I did the year.
What was your biggest takeaway from Avedon?
His generosity, you know, just as how generous he was with the access that people gave to him, right? And it's funny, I've never like fully described it. People are like, oh, really generous? Okay, that's cool, you know. But breaking it down even further, he was very generous with like his stories, keeping his team around him, guiding them forward, but generous in that there was nothing really secret about the process. If you were there as an observer, he wouldn't walk you in like, hey, let me show you how this is being done. Like, he wouldn't do that, but it would be like, here's the psychology. I'm going to show you what the psychology of a sitting looks like through like, hey, I'm going to come in and I'm going to be a little stronger with this because this person's nervous. So make sure you give me the film quickly. I'm not going to do any Polaroids. Okay, let's go. Right. So that was that's the given to the equation. And then seeing him execute the plan, having the talent like, hey, can I have a look? He's like, no, I want to keep going. I love what you're doing. And da-da-da. And it was, you know, somebody asked him afterwards, like, why'd you do that? They're like, well, I knew that if I showed them a Polaroid, even if it was like perfect, exactly what I wanted, they would probably become insecure because the suit wasn't what they chose or whatever. Maybe they were a little chunky or they were hot and sweaty, or he wanted to get an emotion from this person that was attention, right? So you know that for me, it's like the psychology of it all. And this is like one of the biggest trade secrets that I could let out of the bag. But you get to decide what that set feels like as a photographer, you know, or a director or whatever. Like, if you want tension, come in just on a rant and just, come on, man, let's just get after this, man. Just give me the film. Like, come on, man, you fucking, you know, like, yell at your people and, like, just create this, like, discord, you know, and then get to, like, all right, hey, man, sorry, man. It's been a tough morning. Good to see you. Like, all right, come on, let's get out of film. You know, they're not going to be at ease. They're going to be like, fuck, this guy's a dick, and, like, he treated his people like shit. Like, there's going to be an intensity in that glance, unless they're just, you know, sort of
oblivious
or in their own world or, you know, whatever, you know. And then there can be like, oh my god, I love, dude, where'd you get those shoes? They're so dope, man. Like, fly style, how are you, man? You know, I'm super excited, I'm a huge fan of what you do. Like, that person's gonna be at ease. Like, this person knows me, he's complimentary of my style. Like, that's cool, that's really nice. People like to be flattered, you know. And of like course. Then it's just easy, you know.
Well, you're molded,
so you have this, you are able to push and pull, you know. And so I guess beyond the generosity, learning that dynamic was what has enriched my own process.
So the psychology perspective was learned from him. Well, then, but then did you put your two and two together with your degree?
Yeah. Well, the psychology was always fascinating to me, how people interact in general. Was always
but
intriguing.
With photography and being
but
like
with
you
photography
said, the person
to
sitting.
See the example and to realize that I had that component, maybe even more studied. His was through experience and probably didn't have a degree in psychology, but was constantly a psychologist and and manifesting situations, you know, the way he wanted to. But for me, I felt like I even had that was a critical component of my creation and still is. Is the dynamics of a sitting and how you articulate a vision and get it to happen. You know what I mean? Through, you know, sometimes by any means necessary, but with psychology at the core of getting somebody to smile, making them easy. Like, I can break down guards in 10 seconds.
But did that click then? Or did that click after?
After.
You know?
After. But I think just being a genuine, I think one of the biggest gifts is if you're genuine. Like, I am authentically me, whether I'm corny or bossy or gangster or whatever I happen to be in any given moment. You know, like, I am authentically me all the time.
Or on the ground, you know? On your side underneath the car shooting.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, punching somebody's calf when they're trying to, like, support my head and I don't want the support. You know, it's like, when I'm in it, I'm, you know. Yeah, look, I can be hard on assistants. You know what I mean? I can be
But I don't
demanding.
Think it's on purpose. It's the moment.
And a lot of it, too, is like, I tell people, look, if I bark at you or I yell at you or I want a camera faster than you've loaded it, usually it's not against you. You know, like, yes, I probably want a camera, but it's to also show the talent that their time is really important to me. Like, fuck, I'm so sorry that you're having to wait. Come on, guys. Give me a camera. Camera. Come on. Let's go. Like, because you're seeing something, or it's just that, a simple reaction to, like, I know that this is the shot. Give me a camera so I can document this, because that's what I'm here to do, mm-hmm. You know? So, I don't know. I mean, there's level to it all. But, yeah, I would say that I learned a lot of the psychology that I apply on my shoots from Avedon, and I feel that I've gone deeper in later years based on my degree, mm-hmm. and like really saying, okay, like really study that. Like that is probably at the core, you know, that my pictures are always about something. It's a thought, an aspiration, like what's, it's why they always feel like something. It's never like a blank stare and a mouth open, you know, like, yeah. Like that's not what my pictures are about. I want my pictures to be timeless. I want them to stand for a mark of that moment, that individual singular moment that will never be the same again.
All right, so after Avedon, you went to, who's the next guy? You
Mark Ohm. Yeah, he's a Danish photographer, a portrait photographer. Younger guy working his way through, you know, sort of his career that was developing, and, you know,
but much shot different some of the greats. Than Avedon.
Very, very different, you know, very different, you know, sort of younger. And, you know, I worked for him for probably about, I don't know, 8 months. And then I freelanced around for a little while. I worked for a guy named Michael Halsband, who famously did the Basquiat Warhol boxing thing that everybody sees everywhere.
Yep.
He did a lot of album covers. And, you know, while I only worked for him for a short amount of time, it was, he had a big impact. Like, he was sort of a maniac when he was shooting, you know, like all different kinds of films, but it also made me know that I could do it. You know, it's like, give me this filter and that film and cross process that, and don't, like, these are all technical kind of things, but it's the madness to keep organized. And he was frantic with the delivery of shooting, you know what I mean? And the fact that I kept up and had a great attitude and was really happy to be on set with him was always something that he remembered, but also he saw in me the passion to want to do it and to see my work and to have followed my journey. He's like, yo, you always wanted this. Like, and you were just relentless. Like, you just wouldn't stop until you got where you wanted to go.
And where did you want to go?
You know,
at that point, what was your
dream? I think, it's also the early,
because this is what, 90
core tenets of hip hop.
95.
This is 93, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you wanted to be the best. I wanted to be the best.
But what did that mean? Like, where did you want to be at that point? Right? Because all right, 92. You're talking about average music videos $5,000-$10,000.
Yeah.
Right, we're not.
It's never about the money.
No. But I'm just trying to paint a picture of.
Yeah.
This wasn't like, there's all these multimillionaires from hip hop, right?
No.
And all these. So again, that's why I'm asking. What does your dream look like at that point? Is it just to shoot album cover?
I didn't even know that I wanted an album cover.
Videos.
I just wanted to be part of the scene.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to, and I felt like, you know, if I was seen twice as much as the next photographer, somehow that would go in my favor. Like, wow, this kid's everywhere, you know, sort of like the Johnny Nunez effect.
Yeah. So you then know, he's like, shooting parties.
He's everywhere. There's 14 of him. Like, I'm so convinced he's in LA. He's in St. Louis. You know, that was part of it to me. It was like, I believed in the music so much, and I knew that I had important pieces of the puzzle to contribute, because I felt like the photography that was happening, not entirely, but on the whole, I felt like I had more to say.
Okay.
My images were more about storytelling, going to the roots of the artist, going to the home, playground, whatever. Like, it was more the stories I wanted to know, for my own personal and selfish reasons, probably to know more about an artist, but the subject and also the dynamics of a sitting. Like, it was all mixed around in that desire, but more importantly, like, I just felt like it wasn't enough. Like, oh, look, somebody's wearing a pink outfit. Let's put them on a pink background. You know what I mean? Like, yo, what is that doing? Like, cool. Like, I want to go, you know, to your home. Show me. Let me meet your mom. Let me think, like, what did you get your ass kicked? Like, you know, like, tell me the stories. Like, that somehow made the images more important as a gift to the artist and therefore the world to be telling a slice of their authentic story. And that's what I felt my pictures were about and remain about to this day, you know?
I mean, as weird as it sounds, I feel like when people open up, you can feel that in the pictures.
Sure.
Right? Like, you can definitely feel like a picture's flatter, right? When people just don't feel like they're in it, like they're giving you themselves.
Yeah.
They're more just sitting there waiting for you to snap. Like, all right, did the shutter go?
Like, space out, I'm thinking about, like, getting my oil changed of my new truck that I bought. Like,
whereas if you're engaging them.
Or you, like, and that's when you, exactly.
And then you get a lot.
Like, close your eyes and open them again.
Yeah.
You know, like, you just, like, you have little tricks of resetting people's mindset. Like, when you close your eyes and you come back, like, okay, somehow that's a reset. It's like taking a deep breath.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like.
But you got a guide. That just doesn't always,
of course,
right?
But that's why photographers, I feel, the great ones that can guide their set or drive this massive ship sometimes, you know, keep everybody involved so they're all feeling like a part of the journey. You know, that's why that role is so critical. It's never really about you when it comes down to being on set. It's always holding whoever the artist is high, you know. But you're along for that journey, and it's your responsibility to get what you want. Whatever the contents of your brains are that has been approved or maybe even not approved and you're just doing it, you know, it's like you still want to execute that, you know, to the fullest extent.
So how did you get to your first published work then? Like, you now you got this guy, you're inspired, now I want to do some shit, I want to participate, How'd you get to your first published work?
Well, I work for a couple more people. I work for a guy, Stephen Klein, and then I work for Ben Watts. And when I was working for Ben, he was like a younger shooter. He's a couple years older. He's, you know, he was doing stuff for Vibe and Starter and, you know, like just cool stuff that I felt like. And Nike, you know, I was like, oh, this is kind of the work that I want to be doing. You know, but I had started to get a name thanks to relationships that I cherish to this day, but like Heavy D was one of the first people to ever put me on. You know, he was like, you're gonna be my eyes, that's it, like, we're going, let's go. I need you on this video set, I need you in Mount Vernon on Friday, and I need this and this, you know. So he sort of put me under his wing based on me being a man of my word. You know, I was like, yeah, I'm gonna send you this picture. He's like, you photographers are all the same, you're not gonna send me that picture. I was like, watch me. You know, and just made sure that I followed through and sent it. And he's like, all right, man, like, not you passed the first test, but like, okay, I'm gonna send you a car, come on up, man, I want to talk to you, you know. And you know, you show who you are, you know what I mean? And I think that he was just like, okay, this kid wants it, you know. He's gone farther than even people that were on at the time did. I like, I'm gonna give him a chance and show up, let's see what he does next time. And then the consistency. And so that led to opportunities, you know. And like at a party, if he was at, like, oh man, Puff, this is Mannion, you know, like, yo, dope shooter, da da da. Or like, hey, I want to shoot Big Pun, you know, I want you to shoot Big Pun and Bun B, we have a single, come out to the video. Like, yo, Pun, this is my man. He's like, oh, I know him, he shot me for The Source. Like, so it was just this, the reputation was just developing, you know, sort of naturally based on me being really present, excited, and having kind of a different approach to it. I really asked for what I wanted, which led to, you know, for a single cover for this guy called Ill Mentality on Fat Wax. Cool shot, but, you know, I don't know whether he, you know, Sword or whatever. So, and then first magazine cover was, it was either D'Angelo for Touch Magazine or Tyra Banks. It was one of those two. That was magazine first. Oh, man. can't remember, the first album was Jay-Z Reasonable Doubt. You know, and I was just, that was it after that, you know. But like those kind of little moments, I mean, that was still 5 years of really focused, hard work of learning craft, developing a style, being seen, developing relationships in order to get that opportunity to be in the room with Dame, Biggs, and Jay and say, hey, this is what I got. You know, here's my idea. It's rooted in this and not that. And this is where I want to take you. Are you going with me? And they're like, yep, we love it. Let's go. You know? And that was Reasonable Doubt. And that was the guidance, you know, that I offered, that it wasn't the speedboat Scarface story that everybody was just like, everybody was on. It was like,
they just did for the video.
Let's go to, yeah, exactly. You know, it's like, that's part of it. But like, what you're really trying to present is like, yo, plant your feet in Brooklyn. It's about style. It's about presence. It's about, you know, immaculately putting yourself together and still being a gangster, still being about family, but like moving quietly, moving in silence. You know, so I just presented this story through references and they were like, cool, bet. This is it. Let's go.
And then after that, did everything just start rolling?
Or yeah. I mean, I think, you know, that was sort of around the time that Jay sort of kind of moved over to Def Jam, mm-hmm. shortly thereafter. And I remember I had an agent for a hot second because I was still assisting, you know? So I was like, if I get an agent, at least I can have my portfolio there and I can say, hey, Deanna, can you send my portfolio to this record label? And her boyfriend at the time and now husband is Kenny Gravelis, who's one of the premier art directors, Gravelis Inc. They do all movie posters. They're phenomenal. You know, she was my agent early on and believed in what I was doing. And, you know, they got me an opportunity at Def Jam to do Playa's album cover. And I guess it was because it was Shanita Floyd, actually, I found out many years later, who was like, we want to give these R&B singers a little bit of a rougher edge. She wanted to do it with Case and then this. And then I, you know, and I delivered and then delivered and delivered and delivered. As like, then I became sort of like the go-to for Def Jam for a decade, you know, because they knew that I was, you know, he's going to come through with 150 roles because he's a maniac and we're going to have like so many choices that we can do our jobs and still populate everything and give different looks. And, you know, he's great with the artists and we can send him into the trenches. And when we think that we can't get the shot because there's only going to be 5 minutes with an artist, send Mannion because he's going to get it. You know, I was that confident in my skill set, focused to be able to expand the moments with the artists in order to get what I wanted. You know, even if it was a selfish, like, I want one more shot. Like, Ja Rule, I know it's 4 a.m. and you're really, really high, but I want one shot of this on the street in Times Square. You coming with me, man? You know, it's like, oh, man, how do I say no, man? All the pictures all day. We're like, all right, come on, man. Come on. Like,
but that's a skill. Like, that's a tough one to do. Yeah. Right? Because a lot of people don't have that. Has there ever been a moment where you couldn't do it? Where you couldn't get that person to?
Yeah.
And.
Yeah, it's you know, people ask me what my worst shoot was ever, and this was it, and it was just, we just didn't sync up. Like, it was in the meatpacking district, and you know, there was just like innuendos thrown around. I was like, you're just not my guy, man. Like, it's cool, like I got something. It was a free shoot for a friend of an artist who didn't really like, you know. He has a tune, I'm sure many more. I know him for one tune that used to shut down every single party. And I had a moment with him and I was like, okay, I got a good enough shot. I'm cool. Like, yo, thank you for your time. And I just bowed out. And it was, yeah, I was like, I'm good on you, man. I'm not going to work with you again. You know, like, there's very few people that I would say that about.
That's why I had to ask. I mean, because, you know, for the most part, I know you.
Yeah, I couldn't.
You will bend everything you possibly can to get that shot.
Sure. Yeah, if I want it, Yeah, it's only a few times. Like Future, I wanted against this crazy pink background before everybody was into this fluoro pink. It was at Magic City. It was a masculine, dope pink. And I was like, man, I just want one frame. He's like, ah. You know, I didn't understand. I still don't understand Future sometimes. Like, I realized at the end of the second shoot that he actually, like, liked me and was cool, you know? But I had to, like...
It's hard to read. So as a psychology, it's frustrating.
I mean, he called me Anthony for the whole first shoot that I did with him, you know? And I was like, dude, look, I'm looking at this thing on the screen, and it's like, I think these are incredible shots. Like... Do you like this? Because otherwise I'm not doing my job, and we can remix it. I could have a spaceship here in 10 minutes and like a pony and like, you know, half naked. Like whatever what do you want? You know, he's like, nah, I mean, it's cool. I like it. All right, man. And you just like get through the day, you know, and then I photographed him for Mass Appeal down in Atlanta at Magic City. And you know, it was an incredible day. I had women hanging off of stuff, and he was smoked. Like, it was incredible. The shoot was awesome. And at the end of the day, I was like, look, I want one more shot at this hotel room. I want, you know, just sort of like a calmer moment of, you know, a psychological portrait kind of deal. You know, got great stuff. And there was a balcony, and I was out on the balcony, and I couldn't get far enough away. And there was a ledge that went out to, you know, maybe 6 feet out. And I was like, I'm going to climb over this railing. Right. And then I'm going to shoot back in because that's going to give me the distance. But he knew that at the end, there was no other railing to block you. So if I walked out on that thing, I would fall 6 floors to my death. And I was like, hey, I'm going to jump over this railing and I'm going to get that thing. And he's like, please don't. I was like, I put down the camera. I was like, you fucking like me, man. You like me, man. Just face it. You like me. And it's taken me 2 shoots, like, all the way through to crack down this fucking guard. And, you know, I just sort of went on and on. We both were just laughing. But it opened up, and I did the cover shot afterwards, you know. And it was, hey, can I take this picture with you? He's like, yeah, man, come on. Like, I was like, oh, man, you know. I haven't worked with him since, so, you know, we'll see what round 3 brings. But, you know.
Yeah, but that's the fun of it.
But it's a highlight. You know, to me, it's like, you know, when I can bring that up as an opening line. I was like, remember, you like me, and remember my name is Jonathan.
We got two
and let's start
now.
There. You know, like, you know, or you bring him a gift print and you hand it like, yo, this was like one of the greatest days that I had, you know, so.
What was your most dangerous shoot to date? Because you like to put yourself in precarious positions and you like to go to scary places sometimes not thinking of what you're doing.
I know.
I've sometimes been there with you. But you know,
probably
skirt. We're gonna stop it right there. You know, we're gonna hold this one off and we're gonna get it popping again real soon. Stay tuned. We'll be back with part 2 real quick. Like, peace.